I'm a passionate region woman because I believe that your geography is not an obstacle to your success.
I'm a passionate regional woman because to me, regional WA is real and raw.
My work gives me the opportunity to travel all over this incredible state and to meet the most amazing people, for which I'm incredibly grateful.
It's all those personalities that make up our diverse communities. It's the people that make here a vibrant place to live.
I believe regional communities cannot achieve economic prosperity without talented regional women living in rural Australia.
It's what makes regional WA the best place to live and love. And that's why I'm a passionate regional woman.
So, Kayla, we're here again in person.
I know, looking face to face. This is just bizarre. This is a new version of 2020 for us because we're just like saying hey to each other.
I know, it's so nice to see your beautiful face.
Thank
guys,
you.
Guys, Kayla's aura. You just need to be around it sometimes. she just lifts you up.
Stop.
I'm giving the woman fuzzies today and I don't do that a lot, but for you, so always. So we're into episode 6 now. Can't believe it.
No, not even a little bit. I can't believe it at all. Like when we set out to do this, you know, 12 episodes felt like a mountain to climb. But we are at the top on our way back down the other side.
Yes, it's exciting times. So if you're new to listening to our special fortnightly Thursday episode, welcome to the Triple R podcast series with Generation Ag. We're your hosts, Kayla Evans and Lavinia Ware.
Yes, we are. And we are delighted to have you. If it's your first one, welcome. As we said, it's episode 6. So there is a little catalogue building of Triple R Network episodes to go back and listen to. But I'm excited if this is your first that you've landed at this one, because it's actually a really great one. I really, really enjoyed interviewing today's guests. But before we get in, we've got to thank our partners for this series, Triple R Network. Mm-hmm. That is the Rural, Regional and Remote Women's Network of Western Australia, an organisation of which we are massive fans.
Yes, we are. We absolutely love the network, and it's amazing to meet like-minded women who develop ideas, connections and become leaders in their community. I think for young women in our 20s, Kayla and I look up to a lot of these women. They've been able to create a lot of change for us to be able to do what we want to do in our life now. It's amazing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And they're just trailblazers that we are just excited to follow their journeys.
Absolutely.
So on that, amazing women, who is our Woman of the Week this week?
So the Woman of the Week this week is an amazing woman from the Pilbara region. She runs the Yarri Station. Her name is Annabelle Coppin. And if you haven't heard of her, guys, she is like my idol because she not only runs their own beef brand, but she's also the owner and manager. So basically the station was run by her father. And she hasn't married a guy on the station. He doesn't even work on the station a lot, I don't believe. And I think he spends a lot of time with their daughter. But she is focused on station management and she's all about building strong business models for viable, profitable and dynamic future of the northern rangeland of Australia. She's also an active member in the WA Beef Council, working along to facilitate communication, establish partnerships, improve confidence, build resilience and improve sustainability. She also sits on the Live Export Research Committee and she's the chair of the De Grey Land Conservation District Committee. She does a lot and she is actually phenomenal, and the Visible Farmer program, they actually filmed up there and they did an episode on her, and it's one of my favorite ones, so we'll link that below. But she's just a trailblazer for women who actually want to be back on their farm, and she'd be one of the biggest role models to look up to know that, you know, and also the fact that her dad's so forward thinking, and she does touch on that. It's awesome to know that as a woman, you know, we can actually go back and run our farms without having to have a farmer.
100%. Not a prerequisite. Husband is not a prerequisite to being a kick-ass pastoralist, grazier, farmer, whatever it is that you want to be in life. And That's what makes this podcast series so special and the women who appear in it, because they're all just doing amazing things in their own right.
Absolutely. So, Kayla, who is our guest for this week?
So our lovely guest for this week is Lauren Bell, and Lauren is based in Broome, and she has a really cool story, and her story has culminated in bugs, which is pretty dang cool. And I'll let her tell her full story, but I loved chatting to her. She was so, I don't know, just had a really refreshing view on, you know, career and how you can move through your career and just have a go at anything. And, mm-hmm. you know, she grew up in Sydney, you know, right in the metro area of Sydney, and didn't have a huge lot to do with agriculture growing up, studied social sciences at university, mm-hmm. and then somehow ended up on an S. Kidman & Co. property. Did a couple of years there, then ended up teaching young people through TAFE mm-hmm. in agriculture. And now she does some fabulous work in waste management systems using flies, which is just crazy.
Interesting. We've had a few of our women. Belinda Lay as well was from a S. Kidman property venture. Yep. So interesting connection to the land in terms of working as a stockwoman yep. to now actually working in the industry and creating impactful change.
Yeah, all about sustainability, which is just very important of the moment, you know, something we can all get red hot about. So very Absolutely. Cool. So I'm excited to introduce her to you guys.
After completing university in Sydney, a short-term contract in Darwin launched Lauren Bell into a life based in Northern Australia, and eventually a career in beef cattle agriculture on remote stations spanning across Northern Queensland, the Northern Territory, and Western Australia. Working in agriculture, Lauren developed a passion to partake in the challenge of sustainably feeding a growing global population. It was to this sentiment that black soldier fly farming appealed. BSF farming replicates nature's own nutrient recycling process, using insects to upcycle organic waste into sustainable feed and fertilizer products. Now based in Broome, Lauren is using BSF farming to develop a system of organic waste management that builds the economies of regional and remote communities in Northern Australia, not landfills. Lauren's journey from Sydney cider to station hand to fly farmer helps demonstrate that inexperience is no barrier to having a rural experience. Also, that there is a diverse range of opportunities for women to contribute to the future of farming in Australia. Here's Lauren. Lauren Bell, welcome to the Triple R Network podcast by Generation Ag. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Tell us, what was your childhood like?
Sure. So I actually grew up in Sydney, about 20 minutes from the CBD, so very much suburban Sydney. So despite that, both my family had kind of, my mum came from a dairy farm up on New South Wales North Coast, so we still had quite an outdoor lifestyle, visiting her family up there. You know, we got out camping a lot. So yeah, even though I grew up, you know, very much in a suburban area, we still got exposed to outdoors a lot growing up, which was fantastic.
Mm. Do you have many siblings?
Yeah, so I've got an older sister and an older brother, so I'm the youngest. My partner says it shows. I'm pretty spoiled.
That's funny. And then, you know, what happened after school? You went to university?
Yeah. So I felt very much in like the area I grew up, you know, there was that kind of inherent assumption that if you got good grades, then you just went to uni. So, you know, I did quite well at school. You know, I was a bit of a bookworm and stuff. And yeah, so I went to uni because that's just kind of what you did. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I did a really broad degree, called social science, which mm-hmm. I kind of picked because it seemed a little bit less broad than a generics art degree. And I think probably the best decision I made when I was at university was to do an honours year. So I did my 3 years of bachelor, and then really felt after those 3 years that like I just still didn't really know where that degree would take me. I ended up majoring in human geography, which is kind of the intersection of, you know, people and place. But, you know, you don't see too many ads for human geographers on Seek. So I decided to do an honours year. And yeah, like I said, that was probably one of my best decisions, because it's in that year that you really learn a lot of your like critical thinking skills, kind of how to work really independently. So I did a project looking at how microfinance works in the Pacific. So I got to go to Fiji for my field work. And yeah, so it teaches you a lot of skills that aren't just classroom based. So
yeah,
that was probably the best thing about uni.
Yeah. Okay. And what happened next after that? Cause I mean, you've obviously found your way into agriculture at some point. What was that transition like?
Yeah. So it took a while. So when I finished uni, I still felt at a bit of a loose end. And I was getting a bit over living in Sydney. So I just said, oh, look, if I can get a job in Tasmania, New Zealand or Darwin, I would go. And I ended up getting a 3-month contract to work as a research assistant at Charles Darwin University. So off I went thinking, oh, well, you know, if I don't like it, it's only 3 months. And I ended up staying about 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I really just fell in love with the lifestyle in Northern Australia, like the weather, the fact that there's absolutely no commute. I think although sometimes there can be less to do in those areas, it's easier to get involved with what is on offer, because you're not thinking, oh, well, you know, I've got 40 minutes of peak hour traffic to battle before I get home, and can I really be bothered going back out again after that? So, yeah, the social life, the work-life balance up there is just great. So I got really, yeah, I just ended up renewing my contract again and again and stayed. And yeah, I still felt like, oh, I kind of want to do something else. I was due to go back to Sydney for a visit, and I had my motorbike license at the time. So I decided to buy a motorbike and ride back to Sydney. So I went down the Guts through Alice Springs and then across. And yeah, it was on that trip that I just was like, there's so many places in our amazing country that I just haven't seen. And I think growing up in Sydney, often Sydney's kind of seen as like the pinnacle of Australia, and to see anything else you've got to go overseas. Like I had friends who, when I said I moved to Darwin, they were like, what, like why are you going there? Like that was seen as a step backwards almost. So it was really enlightening for me to kind of travel my own country and I guess just say like what beautiful landscapes we have, what, you know, amazing towns, amazing people that I met along the way. And it was on that trip that I was like, wow, like I have this real book-based education, but I actually don't really know how to do anything with my hands. And I think I felt quite inadequate about that. And I stayed a night with some family friends. The father was a agricultural lecturer at the TAFE, and he was talking about, you know, the different things he would teach his students, like how to use a chainsaw and how to go horse riding. And I was like, wow, that sounds amazing, like that sounds like all the skills I want to learn. And so when I got back to Sydney, I went overseas for my sister's wedding. She was living in South Africa at the time, and when I came back I was like, no, that's it, I'm gonna go get a job on a cattle station. And yes, I thankfully someone took me in, because obviously looked pretty useless on paper with my background. And yeah, I ended up on a station in Queensland, just outside of Normanton, which is in the Gulf of Carpentaria. And yeah, I must admit, I was pretty crap. Like that first year, I was very green. I was very lucky to find my way to a station where the manager had a lot of patience and was very willing to, yeah, take me on. And, you know, he said, look, as long as you've got the attitude where you're willing to learn, I'm happy to, I don't expect you to know anything, like, but you need to listen and learn. And yeah, so it was tough. Like, I think it was really eye-opening for me as someone who, you know, not to brag, but like I'd found school relatively easy, and I'd always been kind of well received in the jobs that I had done. So to kind of finally in my mid-20s to be doing a job where I was like, I'm actually really bad at this, and you know, I'm working with 18-year-olds who know more than me. Like, that was a real challenge, like a personal challenge, I guess, to be like, I'm not good at this. Yeah. I can get better, and to stick with it long enough to get better.
Yeah. Can I ask, because we get asked all the time, you know, young people interested in going to work on stations, as someone with no experience, what do you think it was that got you over the line?
I think just like a bit of persistence. Like, I've applied to a lot of places. So I, you know, looked up all the main, you know, kind of companies like Kidman and, you know, NAPCO, and like kind of was sending emails off to them. I was looking in newspapers like the Queensland Country Life. So I think put yourself out there to a lot of places. Don't lie about your experience. Like, nothing is worse for a manager than when he thinks he's got a well-rounded crew, you know, a few newbies, a few experienced people, and it turns out the person he thought was experienced wasn't at all. And, you know, now the camp's weighted towards the more inexperienced. So I think a lot of places do have that one or two places per year for someone who is a novice. You know, obviously they don't want a whole camp full of first years, but they know people have to start somewhere in the industry. So, yeah, don't lie about your experience, but it doesn't hurt to show that you're willing to learn. So I'd gone and done, like, you know, maybe an hour of horse riding lessons just to be like, look, I don't know how to ride a horse, but I have done these to try and, you know, so I can at least know how to put a saddle on and know it's not on backwards, things like that. So I think if you, yeah, if you're willing to say, oh, look, I've done a little bit to get started, maybe done a few units in agriculture at your school, or you've gone and volunteered on a station, or maybe helped out with like a blaze aid group or something, to say, oh, look, yeah, I did 2 weeks fencing. I think that they see, okay, they've got some idea. You know, they don't expect it to be all McLeod's daughters. Yeah, I think just, yeah, be honest is probably the biggest thing, because I've met people who said they were like really good horse riders and then turned up to the station and had to admit to their new boss that they'd actually hardly ridden. And that's, yeah, that's not a good first impression.
Yeah. So how long were you with Eskimen & Co?
So the place in Queensland was actually Arrowbury Pastoral. So I stayed there 1 year. And then, yeah, I decided, I'd been to the Kimberleys when I was living in Darwin just as a bit of a road trip. And I was like, I really want to get back there. And so I managed to, yeah, get a job at Ruby Plains Station, which is outside Halls Creek, and that's a Kidman property. And, yeah, loved it. Loved working there. Had a great year. Again, had a manager that was fantastic and, you know, really willing to just, yeah, show you how to do things and kind of just put you into the deep end. Like, in my first year, they were, everyone got the chance to break in a horse, and I said, oh, look, I don't have that much experience, like, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. And he's like, well, you know, you're only going to learn one way. So yeah, you kind of just have to just, yeah, go along with it sometimes and really challenge yourself. So I ended up staying with them for over 3 years with a bit of a break. So after that first year with Kidman at Ruby, I was again a bit like, I really love this industry, but, like, is it for me? You know, I'm in my 20s, like, as a female, like, can I see myself advancing in this, you know, in this industry? So I moved back to Darwin and went back to working for Charles Darwin University as a research assistant. And after about 2 months, I was like, no, can't do office work anymore. This is not for me. Like, agriculture is where I have to be. And, yeah, I ended up going back to Ruby and doing another 2 seasons there. And then I started working at the live export yards outside Darwin for a while, and then got asked to apply for a job as a, like, as a pastoral trainer and assessor at the North Regional TAFE in Broome. So I, yeah, moved over to Broome and worked there for 3 years, and that was a great job. That involved traveling out to different stations across the Kimberley and Pilbara, and, you know, teaching and training workers on site who were doing, you know, their cert one all the way through to a cert three in agriculture. So yeah, very hands-on, workplace based, just helping them make sure that they were learning all the practical skills that they needed for their certificate, and really helping them understand the, you know, the why behind they were doing things, which I think, given that I came into ag so late, and I remember that first year, I'd be like, well, I've just been told to needle all these cows, but I don't really understand what we're doing or why. Like, I really liked that part of the job, like helping people who were new to the industry to be like, oh, well, we're actually doing this for this reason, and these are these diseases. And I guess just helping them get that really more in-depth understanding of what they were actually doing in their job role, and how everything on the station kind of intersects. Sometimes when you're green, you don't really know why you're doing what you're doing. You're just doing it because you've been told to do it. And
That must have been, you know, nice and full circle for you almost, you know, having started out with no experience and next to no knowledge to be in a position then when you get to nurture other people moving through.
Yeah, I think it helped my teaching style, because I could be really honest with my students and just be like, hey, I've been in your position, you know, like I was pretty crap myself, like, you know, not that long ago. And if you stick with it, you can grow in this industry. And, you know, even with the horse riding skills, like, having learned to ride a horse as an adult, you know, I had that sympathy for my students to be like, I know how it feels when you're trying to control your legs and your arms and your head and a horse, like it's really overwhelming. Whereas I think if you've learned a lot of those skills, you know, as a kid, they're just so inherent to you. Like it's hard to explain that to someone else who's really struggling, who might be like an adult as well. So I think, it definitely helped me have a more inclusive and understanding teaching style, I think, because I'd had that lived experience of struggling to pick up those skills and having been at the receiving end of helpful instruction and unhelpful instruction as well, you know, so knowing what actually helps and what is just not a good way to go about trying to teach someone.
Yeah. So what happens next? How did you make the leap from, you know, massive animals with four legs to tiny little insects with six that is your passion now?
Yeah, it's been quite the pivot, I would say. it was quite random. Like I think so when I was working for the TAFE, I was really enjoying my job role, but I really wanted to get back into a more hands-on ag role. Like I liked the teaching. Like if I was teaching young kids who were really passionate about the industry, like it was great because they were passionate, I was passionate. But then, you know, I struggled with that my job role had to be kind of like step back and get them involved and get them to show me what they were doing. And I was just itching to be like, I just want to run around the backyards myself. Like, so I wanted to try and get back into something a bit more hands-on, and, you know, sustainability in ag has always been like a passion for me. And I was thinking, well, you know, how can I do something up here in Northern Australia in agriculture that's sustainable? So I was thinking, oh, okay, like maybe I can get involved in like rangelands management, or, you know, kind of teaching like how to do better grazing practices and things like that. And so I decided to go back to uni and study a certificate in animal science, just because, you know, all my tertiary education had been more kind of arts related. So I thought, okay, well, it might help to get an actual degree in ag now that I know that's the industry I want to be in. And to be honest, it was while procrastinating from studying that I came across, I was, you know, kind of looking into different permaculture websites, and I came across this idea of basically rearing insects as a cheap way to feed chickens. And it just kind of really struck me, that idea, and I was like, oh, that's quite interesting. And the more I looked into it, the more I was like, oh, like this is actually something you could do as a business. Like, you know, like I wonder if people are doing this. And then it turns out that people are. There's companies internationally and within Australia that, you know, use insect farming as a way to kind of recover organic waste from landfill and to produce sustainable protein. And I just, it was almost like that real classic light bulb moment. Like I just instantly felt like this is something I have to be involved in. And I just had this really burning sensation of like, if I don't start working in this space now, like someone else is going to come along and take this opportunity. Because it really just felt like this amazing opportunity to get involved. And I don't know if that's because there's so much more awareness now in Australia around food waste and stuff that I was like, you know, there's that real buzz around it at the moment about, you know, how can we mitigate it? How can we, you know, do better with it? But yeah, I just remember like chatting to my partner and just being like, oh, I've just really got to get involved with this. I've really got to give this a go. So I ended up, I dropped down to part-time work at the local crocodile park, as you do, so that I could, have part of my time to focus on trying to start a business around insect farming. And that's kind of been what I've been doing for the last years now.
Yeah. Tell us, you know, you're the founder of Waste Not Food Recycling. Do you want to share with the listeners a bit more in detail what that is? And I guess your elevator pitch is always a good place to start.
Sure. So basically I'm trying to create a system of organic waste recovery that builds regional economies, not landfills. So what that means is diverting organic waste away from landfill and upcycling it into products that can be used by other local industries. So at Waste Not, we do that through black soldier fly farming. So the black soldier fly is like a naturalized non-pest species of fly. So they're already here in Australia. They probably came over in like the 1900s on ships. They're originally from kind of the Americas. It's quite a warm weather species. And the adult fly, if you look up a picture of them, they actually look more like a wasp than a fly. But the adult fly has no mouthpiece, so they don't bite or transmit disease. They're not like your pesky house fly that, you know, buzzing around trying to land on your dinner. Because they have no mouthpiece, their larvae are these voracious feeders because they have to put on all their energy stores to get them through metamorphosis and then their adult life. And so they're really good bioconverters of organic waste or food waste into larval biomass. And then, so basically you collect food waste, you feed it to the larvae, and then you harvest the larvae, and they become a protein source that can be used in aquaculture and poultry feeds. So rather than depending on fish meal or soy protein, this is a really sustainable, cost-stable source of protein. And the thing that still blows my mind about it is you're kind of solving these two contemporary problems which seem really divergent. So you've got, you know, the problem of food waste on the other hand and the problem of, like, overfishing and, you know, humanity's kind of increasing need for protein and how do we meet that in a sustainable way. And it's this one single solution to both those problems. And it's just nature's way of recycling nutrients. But now we're just trying to do it commercially to meet the commercial level of food waste that we have.
That's so interesting. And what about the, I guess, what's left over at the end of like the fly process with what's left? Does it go into agriculture? Did I read that correctly?
Yeah. So what's left, so basically after the larvae have consumed all the food waste, what you have left is what we call the frass, which is basically just like the larval feces and any kind of residual food waste left behind. So, you know, you might get a bit of banana skin that they haven't consumed, or maybe there was like a paper napkin or something that was included and they haven't eaten that. And so that is actually a really nutrient balanced soil improver. So it's got quite a high nitrogen level, so you can't apply it straight away, but you can compost it or feed it into a vermiculture system or even into like an aerobic digester to get biogas. And then it turns into a fertilizer that can be used ideally, in horticulture or, you know, on fodder crops and things like that.
That's so interesting.
There's not really any waste. Like at the end, it's either the protein or the fertilizer product. So
yeah. And what are we talking about in terms of volume? You know, how many fly larvae and, you know, on what volume of waste are we talking here?
Yeah. So yeah, you do need a lot of larvae. You know, a commercially operating fly farm would be trying to produce like, you know, upwards of 1 million larvae a day. Because obviously, you know, you're talking about they consume like 0.0025 grams of food waste a day per larvae. So to process food waste at scale, you do need quite a big operation, but you can go vertical, so you can kind of stack your feeding tubs so that you can actually produce a lot of protein in quite a small footprint area.
So talk to me, I'm trying to visualize what a setup might be like. Are they in sort of like a 60 odd liter tub that we would picture at home, or are they in much bigger containers than that? How does that work?
Yeah, so generally the smaller tubs, only because at the moment a lot of it's still quite manual handling based. The industry as a whole is definitely researching how to go to more automated processes, but you know, it is still quite an emerging industry, so a lot of those kind of processes are still being developed. So yeah, generally, yeah, kind of your 60 liter tubs, you might have 10,000 larvae in that, and then you'll feed, you know, a set volume of food waste into that tub per day, 14 day period, and so then you might have, you know, a couple of hundreds of those tubs, depending on how much food waste you're trying to process. And then yeah, that's kind of the, I guess, the feeding kind of hub. And then to keep the daily supply of larvae that you need kind of coming to keep processing that food waste, you have like a captive breeding colony. So you allow about, you know, 5% of your larvae to complete their whole life cycle and turn back into flies. And then you set them up in a situation that encourages them to breed. And then, you know, you obviously collect their eggs and that's kind of where the cycle continues. And that was one of the reasons I was really interested in applying it to in Broome, is because they're quite a tropical species. So thankfully up here they can breed all year round with minimal climate intervention, whereas in Europe and North America, and even some companies that are doing it in kind of more southern Australia, they have to have these quite climate controlled warehouses, artificial lighting, artificial heating, artificial humidity to create the correct environmental conditions for these flies to breed all year round. And that was something I saw as a real advantage in Broome, that we could do it without that. And I hope to kind of leverage that advantage in the future to maybe establish quite a big breeding facility up here, which then can supply eggs or larvae to other facilities elsewhere in Australia who might not have the climate or the expertise to maintain their own breeding colonies, because there's a lot of people who are really interested in this space and this area of black soldier fly farming, but if you're a startup and you're staring down, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 years of research and development into just getting the things to breed reliably, that's a bit of a disincentive. So I'm really hoping if I can establish a breeding facility that can really accelerate the industry in Australia by helping get other enterprises involved sooner, and get them processing waste, get them creating a turnover quicker, so it can become, yeah, a bigger industry in Australia.
Yeah, wow. And I know a huge part of it for you is the impact that this system can have on the economy and the community. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's something that I really didn't want, you know, I mean, my passion obviously is Northern Australia, like, you know, kind of ever since I moved to Darwin, I haven't really gone back south, or, you know, aside from Darwin, I haven't really lived in another metro area. And I just felt like, you know, I didn't want Northern Australia to kind of lose out on this opportunity to really benefit from this kind of new and emerging and innovative industry. And I think one of the real benefits that it brings is a lot of communities in Northern Australia are really kind of underserviced in terms of organic waste management. And that's generally because, you know, when people think of organic waste management, they think of composting. But then, I know even here in Broome, the Shire looked into that, but they're like, you know, we are so far from the market. Like, how, where do we offload this compost if we do that? Like, how do we do that in a financially viable way? And so it's just, if it's not financially viable, like, communities aren't going to redirect organic waste away from landfill. So, and black soldier fly farming really offers this opportunity to do organic waste recovery in a viable way in these communities, because it creates these products that have local markets and are really valuable. So the protein can be used, you know, like I said, in aquaculture or poultry diets. You know, the the fertilizer can be used in horticulture, or, you know, if it's fed into like a vermiculture system, you know, a lot of home gardeners would be really interested in using it. So it kind of overcomes a lot of those barriers, such as like the distance market that I think currently restrict regional communities, you know, who are, you know, they're struggling. They want to obviously divert organics from landfill because everyone knows, you know, organics and landfill, like they take up space, you know, they produce greenhouse gases, they have, you know, problems with leachate, like that can pollute groundwater. So no one wants organics in landfill, but there has to be a viable way to do something with it. And I think like solidified farming really offers that. And then, you know, there's the whole, it's a new industry. So it's, there's job creation and industry diversification. And in Broome, you know, we've seen this year how like a reliance on tourism, it's not healthy because you obviously had all the travel restrictions due to COVID. And the town really, really suffered. So I think it's important for regional communities to have that diverse economic base. And I think that, yeah, this can be part of that.
Yeah, so beautiful. Can you share a little bit more? You touched on it briefly before, but I'd love to, you know, what it is about sustainability and this waste management system that just really lights you up.
Yeah, I guess food waste has, you know, my mum grew up on a farm, and so growing up we always had chickens and worm farms. So, like, you know, food waste wasn't something that just went in the bin. And I think I got a shock when I moved out of home and living in apartments, and you're like, oh, well, you just scrape all this food waste into the bin, or you clean out your fridge and it just goes in the bin. And I think then once I started working in ag, and you see how much effort goes into producing our food, and how much energy and resources from, yeah, the production to the processing to the trucking, you know, before it gets to the consumer, like, it's so much time and energy and resources have been poured into that. And it just seems so odd then that its end of life is just a hole in the ground. So I've always been quite passionate about food waste and dealing with food waste in a better way. And I think the sustainability thing, again, just like the more I traveled around Australia and seeing what a beautiful country we had, of like, well, how can we, yeah, be a food bowl for the world, but do that in a way that protects our own environment. You know, and I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. It's just about being innovative in the way we approach.
Yeah. And I guess the reason you're on the podcast today is because of your participation in the AgriFutures Rural Women of the Year Award as a finalist this year. Can you talk about your experience of applying for that award and what that was like for you?
Sure. I was a bit of a reluctant applicant, I guess. I think, you know, I just felt incredibly wanky to nominate yourself. Like, I'm a rural woman, I'm amazing, like, I should definitely get this award. So, you know, obviously I was very attracted to applying because of the platform. You know, there's like the bursary attached if you're the winner, which, you know, was attractive to me because I'm like in a startup stage with my business. So, you know, always on the lookout for funds. And so, you know, there was a lot of reasons I was like, oh, I kind of want to apply. And, you know, it took my sister to give me quite a stern talking to of like, you know, like, if you don't put yourself out there, you don't get anything back. Like, you know, what you've got a good idea, like, don't let your kind of, I don't know, your humility hold, or I don't know, your lack of confidence hold you back. So I did apply, and yeah, like, I'm the kind of person who, I hate writing resumes where you have to go on about bang on about your skills and how amazing you are. So, like, it was kind of like pulling teeth for me going through the application process. But the experience from then on, it really has been great. So to make it to the finals was, for me, just such an amazing validation of my project idea, because, you know, I'd kind of been working on it quietly in the background for the last, you know, nearly 2 years, and I'd gone for a few grants and had missed out. And, you know, so you start thinking like, am I on the right track here? Like, you know, I'm really passionate about this idea, but, you know, maybe I'm just barking up the wrong tree. So, you know, to get through to the finals with an award like the AgriFutures Award, which is, you know, really prestigious and has like, yeah, very high level and a diverse range of people on their judging panel, that was a real, yeah, confidence boost. And presenting to the panel in the finals was great. Like, they were really encouraging, supportive panel. Like, there was no Shark Tank vibe of like, oh, yeah, prove your worth. Like, why should you be here? Like, they were already like, we think you guys are amazing. Like, we just want to hear more about your story. And mm-hmm. yeah, it was great to connect with the other finalists too. And I think to see the diversity of what women are doing in, you know, rural and regional areas, that it's not just all about like, oh, you've got to be a farmer, or, you know, like, we had people working in like Indigenous engagement and suicide awareness, you know, people developing tech around ag. Like, it was really inspiring. So I think for anyone who is thinking about applying and holding back, just go for it. Like, it really is a worthwhile experience.
Yeah. And has it offered any opportunities for you since then? Any exciting developments out of that opportunity?
Yeah, I think just the platform that it opens up and the people you get to meet through that. So, you know, I was lucky enough to meet Minister McTernan because she came up to do a little award ceremony for me and the winner, Cara Peake, because we're both based in Broome. And so to get the chance to actually have some face-to-face time with her and talk about my project was amazing. The Triple R Network has been really invaluable in terms of, I guess, keeping that momentum going of getting the, you know, the project out there and the stories out there, because particularly this year with, you know, COVID kind of dominating the news cycle, I had really felt like, did I make the most of this? Like, did I get enough coverage as I should have? And, you know, they've really stepped up in so many ways through, you know, offering this chance to do the podcast. You know, they've done like online webinars with their members, which helped me get in touch with some really great people. You know, they've done editorials on us. So, yeah, they've really helped, I guess, expand that experience of, you know, really just having this platform to get up and tell your story and get it out there in front of the right people. So,
yeah,
that's been great.
That's really cool. So what's next for you? Do you have any exciting plans or even blue sky ideas for the future that you'd love to share with us?
Yeah, so keen to really get a facility established here in Broome. So I've been doing a lot of trials on quite like a research and development scale, but really hoping to kickstart a commercial pilot by the end of this year or the beginning of next. And I really want to use that, I guess, the facility in Broome, or the, you know, establishing it here in Broome, as a bit of a road test to develop a model that can be used in other regional communities, because, you know, I mean, obviously I'm super passionate about the positive impacts that this can have in, you know, environmentally and in terms of job creation, and I'd love to see that replicated elsewhere. So yeah, that would be, I guess, my blue sky picture, the Black Soldier Fly Farm in, you know, kind of every community across the north. And, you know, I guess hopefully moving to a future where it's not an emerging industry anymore. It's just seen as standard as sheep or cattle farming is.
Yeah, that's so cool. Fly farming, it's awesome. Before we go, the last question we always ask is, how can the listeners get in touch with you if they connect with your story, they want to find out more, where can they go?
I've got a website, which is just www.wastenotfoodrecycling.com.au, or they can email me directly at lauren.bell@wastenotfoodrecycling.com.au as well. And I am on Facebook, which I'm pretty sure my handle's wastenot_au. So
awesome.
Just Google it. I'm sure you'll find me.
Yeah, that's amazing. Lauren, thank you so much for your time today. And this has been so intriguing. I've been so interested to do this interview with you. So thank you for sitting down with me this afternoon.
No, thank you so much for taking the time and allowing me to talk a bit more about the Black Soldier Fly Farming.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Triple R Network podcast by Generation Ag. Stay tuned for another episode in this series in a fortnight's time.